You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, your fortnightly food and drink programme for Cambridge. And thanks to Tim and Julian for the last 2 hours of Jailbreak. I'm Matt Bentman.
I'm Ruth Reyes.
And I'm Alan Alder. And coming up on today's programme, what would you find on the menu if you stepped into a Cambridge pub in 1588? We pop back in time to place an order with Thomas Hobson of Hobson's Choice fame.
Andrew Webb delves into his historical bookshelf to bring a review of They Can't Ration These, a wartime cookbook about foraging. Cue the nettle toast, hare pate and truffles in cinders.
Nazima Pathan from Franglais Kitchen questions how strong the evidence is for foods being good or bad for you.
Whilst Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments talks about starting vegetables off indoors to give them a head start.
Ruth revisits the Espresso Library to see how they're getting on following their first month in business.
And Matt talks with Duncan Mason, the new owner of Urban Larder on Mill Road, which reopened a few days ago.
In addition, we have some cookbook reviews, one of which has been developed from a successful cookery blog. And of course, as usual, there will be a roundup of the latest food and drink news from the university and the city.
The Urban Larder is a cafe, coffee shop and arts and crafts business all in one. Everything you can find there comes from local producers. Polly Pluvier first opened Urban Larder on Mill Road in 2009. And I decided to hang up her apron late last year, exhausted, but exceedingly happy with what she had achieved.
At that time, Duncan Mason returned from London looking for a fresh challenge. He hails from Bury St Edmunds and fondly recalls Mill Road as a mecca, stepping out of the Salvation Army shop in the early 90s with his first record player and collection of Stevie Wonder albums. And this feature is about Duncan and the new life he's taken on, from Lewisham to the Larder.
How would you introduce yourself, just to give us the essence of who you are and why you've taken this on?
I would say I'm a man of... Oh, that's a good question. I'm hopefully a fun, likeable, humorous person, and... Do that again. Who isn't a keen food enthusiast? I'm a very keen food enthusiast. I like to try new things, I like to get to new places, I like to stumble on new gems. There's no snobbery in it, if you like. I have a simple idea. I think food should be high quality and then accessible for all. Yeah, to be honest, apparently I first tried to serve people as a coffee shop owner when I was 4 years old.
Really?
Yeah, so my mum tells me. Okay. And it's always been a dream to get into catering. And I worked in pubs and restaurants from 16 for 6, 7, 8 years whilst I was studying. And I think I always knew that perhaps I wasn't cut out for office life. And so this is no knee-jerk reaction. This is a long time in the making. You wouldn't work on the market on wet and windy weekends if you weren't really interested in it, as I'm sure the long-serving market traders will tell you.
So some people wanted to be engine drivers, some people wanted to be doctors, lawyers, builders. You knew, but even back then, coffee was the thing.
I've always wanted a sandwich bar or a coffee shop. More recently, as palates have changed, it's become a coffee shop. I like the coffee, I like the sandwiches, I like more the atmosphere and being somewhere that you're quite happy and comfortable hanging out, really. I'm sort of coining the phrase storeroom deli at the moment, and the premise, not that I'm making up as I go along, but the premise I'm going with is the things that capture my imagination are the things that I'll put on the shelf. And just yesterday I was talking to a company, Retrocorn, that make popcorn the flavour of boiled sweets, so we'll have Cola Q popcorn and sherbet lemon popcorn, which again is all gluten free. It's really, I think if things interest me, then hopefully when people come into the shop, they will interest them and they will enjoy them. It's as simple a premise as that.
Yeah.
Cambridge is that sort of place. It's one of the reasons I came here. You meet one person, it leads to another link.
For example, I was saying I was working with Ben on Cafe Mobile on the market. His girlfriend has a bakery just down the road here, up and coming, and she's going to supply me the cakes that currently are only found at Cafe Mobile. So, again, it's just connecting the dots, I guess.
Yes, yeah. Ben of Cafe Mobile. I never knew you were such a staunch tea drinker.
Oh, I do love a nice cup of tea. I can't drink coffee all day. It makes me too manic.
Now, Duncan mentioned that when he first returned to Cambridge, he came and answered an advert that was placed by you.
Yeah. We kind of met up and I realised he was the right man for the job. And he was very honest from the start, said that he was thinking about this this cafe dream of his in Cambridge, how he just wanted to gain some experience. In the long run, it has been mutually beneficial because my girlfriend, who supplies the cakes for my stall, is now going to supply Duncan at his cafe.
Right, what have we got? The best seller,
yeah,
is chocolate brownies. We'll probably sell three of those to every one of everything else. We've got a few tried and tested classics, so like an apple and cinnamon cake. And more recently, we're trying to offer a few gluten-free options, and I'm amazed at how popular those are. I think there's a lot of people who need gluten-free cakes in Cambridge. We always try and like, have one out there that looks vaguely healthy, but don't believe it. Everything's got lots of butter and sugar in it.
Interestingly, met lots of different traders, some of which are bringing their products to here. I got to meet Alison of Alison Reed Chocolates, been selling her chocolates on the craft markets on Saturdays.
Yep. I met Duncan, I think it was last summer. Came across as a really, you know, fun character, very friendly. So, yeah, a couple of months ago, he approached me about stocking my chocolates in Urban Larder, which is great. So that runs alongside the fact that I sell them in Cambridge Market Saturdays, Sundays and Mondays. You probably spot my chocolates because of their designs, really. They're a lot like marbles, people say, because they're so shiny and they have swirls and splashes of colour.
And indeed, the stamps for my loyalty card and my takeaway cups are being made by Alan down on the market as we speak now. So it's been a great bedding experience. Hopefully our customers I met there, well, I will see coming up into the shop now we're on Mill Road.
Yes, because I was reading an article online and they mentioned that last Mill Road Winter Fair, you were serving directly outside, weren't you?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Yes, the ownership hadn't changed hands at that point, so I came in to help Polly meet some of the regulars, and I took up position sort of outside of the shop and served from a stall there, bringing all my newfound market experience and just selling hot chocolates and cake and meeting people. It was a great day. It was a lot of fun. I look forward to doing it next year as the owner of the shop and seeing how we can go bigger and better.
There used to be a big raised desk.
There's two benches,
yes.
High benches, if you like, by the window, yes. I was keen just to reduce everything, maximise the space.
Mm.
And also, we've got a beautiful sash window, which if you walk along this area of Mill Road, few have now, yeah. And it opens. And actually, that's
what it opens.
It opens. And when I first came into Urban Lara in the summer,
yeah,
that's what really drew me in, is in the summer, you open the window, you let all the air in. So I thought it'd be nice to install a bench underneath it and make a real feature. Just open up the space and make it appealing to look into. So it's all just about very simple vision of clean lines, fresh.
Do you know, I never noticed that the whole front opened because I was always, my eye was drawn to the raised tables.
Yes.
And then you look at the people that are already in here drinking. But the fact that you've got the entire front of your shop is one gigantic window.
It's literally a sales window. And I, again, this is all based on the plan, but it's organic and we'll take it whichever direction works. I haven't ruled out the possibility of selling ice creams out the window, or it lends itself to Mill Road Fair, it lends itself to a number of different possibilities. We've largely kept the layout as it is. We've kept the old counter and sanded that down, so that's still here. There was coffee and hot chocolate and tea here, mm-hmm, but we're probably just putting a greater emphasis on it. So what we have done in terms of trying to maximise the space is, one of the things that was very popular in the Urban Larder, mm-hmm, was the sort of frozen food and the gluten-free element in that people knew they could come here and get. But what we have done is tried to tuck it away into what we're now terming the pantry,
yeah,
if you can have a pantry within a larder. And the freezer element is there. We're getting produce from Melon Bakes still, gluten-free flours and bread mixes from Gleb Farm. So again, that will all be housed efficiently so as to maximise space and not get in the way of the counter on which food and cake will be displayed.
Is this the biggest project you've undergone?
Personally, yes.
Yeah.
I've worked in an office for the last 14 years.
Oh, right. This is, God, this is the breakout.
This is it. I should have a TV programme filming, shouldn't I? This is the this is the live stream thing. So, this is either, brave, idiotic, inspiring, one of the three, all three perhaps. Time will tell.
Yeah, but definitely worth doing. You feel completely 100% positive.
It's been brilliant. It's a strange sort of stress. It's an exhilarating stress. At the moment, getting things done, but I wake up wanting to crack on with them. No need for alarm anymore, I'm quite happy to do it. And I'm essentially pledging myself to this place 6-7 days a week. I'm about to move two roads down. I live off Cheston Road at the moment. This is now my life's work.
It's the right feeling to have though, isn't it?
Oh, it's a great feeling to have. And so it's very exciting to open up the doors and get people in. And as I said, hopefully people will come in and they'll realise whilst it's changed, there's still friendly faces here. All the staff are still the same. And it would be lovely to think of people sitting down at the tables that I've made, drinking coffee that I'm here serving. Whilst the decor has changed, the ethos hasn't since Holly left. So I'm sure a few people will be perhaps surprised, hopefully pleasantly surprised, at what we now look like. But it's still based on the same premise of somewhere that has little pretense, is welcoming to all, can be the hub of the community. You can sit in, you can meet people, you can have a good high-quality coffee, something to eat, but equally buy something to take home. Mm. And in that vein, I think we're hoping to continue the work, the last 6 years' work that Polly has put in.
Well, Duncan, it's been excellent to meet you. And we are here at Urban Larder, 9 the Broadway on Mill Road.
Most definitely 9 the Broadway, yes. Over the bridge, out of town, and on your left.
When will you be opening?
Tuesday, the 3rd of March. So hopefully by the time this is aired, we'll have been open, we'll have got over our opening hiccups, and we'll be a slick operation that everyone will be wanting to visit.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Duncan.
Cheers, thank you.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Continuing the ethos of original owner Polly Pluvier, Duncan's Urban Larder is an evolution rather than a revolution. You'll find it still full of gluten-free foods, arts and crafts, coffee, music and atmosphere, and of course, Duncan. The new Urban Larder is open now on the Romsey side of Mill Road, next to the Sea Tree Fish Bar and a few doors down from the Black Cat Cafe.
Every afternoon, 105 Drive wraps up your day with a mix of music and conversation. We'll talk to the people who make Cambridge.
Cambridge got ahead of the game in turning ideas into commercial success.
Keep you up to date on the latest sport.
He was only at Cambridge United for 2 months, but he had a huge impact. He scored the opening goal in the FA Trophy final.
And bring you regular features on food, drink, technology, the movies, and what's happening in town.
I am so excited. This is going to be awesome.
In between, there's the latest news, weather, and travel every 20 minutes to see you through the traffic. Join me, Julian Clover, Monday to Friday from 4, 105 Drive, on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
In our last episode, Nazima Pathan from Franglais Kitchen talked about broccoli, as purple sprouting broccoli is back in season and on the market. Today, Alan asks her, how good is research that backs up superfood health claims?
Nazima, can we just talk about some health aspects of food, which is something we really steer clear of on Flavour, because there's so many spurious claims made, which I think can cause people harm if they follow them and they're not well justified.
Yeah.
But since, you know, you have a doctor and you have recent research information, is broccoli good for you? Is it particularly good for you?
Well, I think you make a really important point, which is that there's a lot of talk about superfoods, and I don't like to call any food a superfood, and I think most good dietitians and nutritionists would agree. Some vegetables do have a better nutrient content than others. However, as long as you're eating a diet that has varied colour and a good quantity of fruit and vegetables, it's good for you. In terms of broccoli, the great things in it are that it's very rich in vitamin C and in folate, and as well as having some plant-based carotenoids, which are vitamin A kind of molecules. So those things are in there that you need, and so it's good to have. Also, being a green vegetable, a diet rich in green vegetables is good for you, the fibre as well. And some of the chemicals, the phytochemicals, which are in broccoli, there is some suggestion that they do have good antioxidant and potentially sort of anti-cancer activity. But that's something that has been reported but not proven in any kind of clinical trials. But And yet, it can't be doubted it's good for you.
Almost everybody believes that antioxidants will help you avoid or reduce the likelihood of getting cancer, but yeah. What you're saying is it hasn't really been...
Well, it's interesting. If you start to look at research, I mean, most of these health nutrient claims aren't really backed up by good science. So, for example, if you talk about antioxidants, certainly, you know, whether or not... They're the ones that are in plants or seeds are there to protect the seed or the plant from damage, from oxidant damage. Are they going to get absorbed into the mitochondria of your cells where they can have an antioxidant effect? I think there's very little evidence that they do, even at high doses, get in there. So, you know, it's and your body mostly does a reasonably good activity of that. And also reactive oxygen species, which are antioxidants acting in some of them, are being produced by your body for a purpose, which is to kill bacteria, to have some other kind of effect. So it's all about balance and remembering that, you know, not to just believe hype.
Is it, but when hype is all you hear, which
I mean,
is the case,
press, isn't it?
You know,
it's
for most of us.
The headline-grabbing sort of Huffington Post or Daily Mail articles on foods to make you younger.
Yes.
And, you know, putting up a model or Gwyneth Paltrow, who says, you know, that she looks like she does because of what she eats, you know, which is a macrobiotic diet. Well, you or I eating it are not going to look like Gwyneth Paltrow.
I'm quite pleased about that.
However hard we try and however much of a macrobiotic diet we eat, I think there's a lot of genetics as well.
But there has been, hasn't there? Because it was done on life prisoners in the USA. There has been a lot of research done on the effect of vitamin deficiency.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, obviously you'll see that again. That's clear. You need vitamins, and that's why you need to eat a certain number of fruit and vegetables a day. And it was 5, now they say 7. I find that quite hard to ingest in a day. But I think that what I try to do is to have a varied sort of colour intake, because that suggests, you know, from tomatoes you might be getting things like lycopene, which, because of its red colour, you know, it has certain things in it. Obviously the citrus will have certain other nutrients. So I think as long as you try and vary it and eat as fresh as possible. The great motto is that one by Michael Pollan, which is eat food, mostly plants, and not too much. You know, so it's sort of eat real food. Be an omnivore, but plants are probably, you know, really important, and we see that with, you know, the health benefits of societies that eat less meat and perhaps eat more seafood and plants in terms of certain cancers.
Yeah, it's quite surprising that there's no convincing evidence that antioxidants are all they're cracked up to be. Of course, that doesn't mean that they're not, just that the evidence isn't strong, or at least it isn't strong yet. But some health claims about food really are remarkably odd, and some rather silly ones seem to be about body acidity. And one we heard on Flavour was that you can reduce acid levels by drinking lemon juice, which counteracts acidity. But I think children aged 11 learn that lemon juice is actually an acid itself, and it's so it can't possibly have that effect. And the body itself monitors levels of acidity in the blood and reduces it if it's too high. I could go on for a long time about this sort of thing, so I shall contain myself. But by the way, Nazima's recipes can be found on her website, frongleykitchen.com. Her homepage is full of her most recent recipes, the latest being miso soup with tofu, asparagus, cabbage and furikake seasoning. Lovely.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
Andrew Webb is an award-winning food journalist, author of Food Britannia and the Men's Pie Manual. He works with BBC Radio, Channel 4 and others, and Andrew also regularly contributes to Flavour, with a look at an unusual or little-known cookbook from his shelf. In previous instalments, he's talked about a book from Charles Darwin's grandson that featured Cambridge sauce, Cambridge sausages and Huntingdon pudding. In another instalment, Molly Castle's Round the World with an Appetite from 1936 featured her take on fascism and concentration camps. Quite unusual topics for a cookbook. Today, Andrew covers a title about foraging by a French aristocrat whose father knew Napoleon.
This week on the Historical Bookshelf, we're turning to wartime matters, and I have here a reprint of They Can't Ration These by Vicomte de Mauduit. That's obviously a French name. And he was stationed here during the war, and he was a sort of French aristocrat, born in 1893. His great-grandfather went to St. Helena with Napoleon, and his father was a cavalry officer. So he came from this kind of highly noble French military stock. He's believed to have been captured by the Nazis after the fall of France and apparently died in Germany. But this book is an attempt by him, during wartime, to sort of talk about the things that people can forage and find in the countryside. And that's why it's called They Can't Ration These, because it's essentially a kind of guide to foraging before it was all kind of hip and trendy. And, you know, he takes something as simple as nettles. He says here, "There are fields of wastelands running to seed and neglected, many nutritious, delicious plants and herbs. So let us pick up our baskets and knife and go grubbing. Wild vegetables as well as wild berries will be turned into appeasing dishes." Nettles get a lot of use. We've got nettle soup, puree of nettles, nettle toast, hare pate, stewed rabbit, grouse, truffles in cinders. I mean, this is kind of interesting that he's talking about truffles, which we now think of as as the height of luxury, but they do grow in this country, particularly in sort of Hampshire and sort of the sort of moist western end of the country. Roast cygnets, there you go. Swan, anyone? Ptarmigan. But my favourite recipe in here, just for the sheer kind of audacity of it, is baked hedgehog. And that is a dish that you think, wow, that's something you don't see on the menu anymore. The hedgehog is a delicacy which few people have tasted, perhaps because the uninitiated first think of the prickles and how to get rid of them. There is a way of doing this, and this is known as the Romany way. After killing the hedgehog, clean its insides, then roll it thickly in some moist clay and put in a moderate oven and bake till the clay is quite hard and dry. Break the clay by cracking it with a stick or hammer, and the prickles and top skin, which will adhere to the clay, will come off with it. Lastly, skin the legs. Wow, that's a bit of a home ec tip there, isn't it? If you ever find yourself in need of eating hedgehogs. So after kind of extracting the meat, he says, "Having prepared the hedgehog as above, it can be cooked in different ways, either roasted or fried as chicken, stewed as rabbit, or made into a pate as for hare pate." Other recipes in here are things like squirrel. This is another great delicacy, the flesh of a squirrel being more tasty and tender than that of a chicken. He's got squirrel tail soup, roast squirrel, stewed rooks, rook pie. There you go. Actually, there was a place in Scotland recently that sold rook pie. They managed to get them. Baby rooks are called branches, I think. And when they first sort of are being fledged and they're sort of hovering around the nest, that's the best time to shoot them and make a rook pie. You have to soak it in milk, the rook breast, apparently, because it can go kind of green colour. So he's got in here roast sparrows. Sparrows, when roasted this way, are far from despicable. You just think, crikey, there's not much meat on a sparrow. It's the interesting things that we just don't think about now, like hedgehog. I mean, even squirrels are sort of, a hard thing to come by. But here we've got some sauerkraut, spinach, cabbages, purslane. You know, there are kind of foraging chefs now who are kind of getting all excited about things like rose petal jam. And these guys were doing it in, 1940s. Chrysanthemum soup. Pour 1 pint of milk in a pan, heat, and when it's just coming to the boil, stir in 2 tablespoons of corn flour and continue to stir until thick. Add the chopped petals of one large chrysanthemum, which has been previously soaked in boiling water. Serve hot. That just sounds horrible, doesn't it? So yes, it's worth looking at from a historical point of view and just how close we came during the war to kind of running out of food. You know, a lot of food was being sunk in the North Atlantic by U-boats. But it's just, there's also some lovely tips in here about making vinegars and sugars. Here's another one, coffee. During the Napoleonic Wars, when a shortage of the imported coffee bean arose, Napoleon offered a big prize for a substitute, and this was the winning recipe. Gather the berries of the grown asparagus plant, dry them, as when required, and roast them in a coffee roaster or hot oven. The nectar has a caramel flavour and is very agreeable. Roasted and ground chicory roots can also be added. And chicory is a common coffee substitute back in those days. In fact, in Malta, where, you know, that's an island that's seen a lot of blockades and such things, they still prefer a little bit of chicory in with their coffee. He's also got here dandelion coffee. Coffee made from dandelion roots is not only delicious to the taste, but also restorative to the kidneys and liver. It is also cordial to the digestion. This is almost health food shop stuff here. So, and then I like the final chapter. So you've done all this kind of scrimping and saving. You've served your hedgehog surprise with your salsify and chrysanthemum soup, and it's got homemade wines and beers. Gorse wine. Now, this is quite good, actually. And Hugh Finley Whittenstall made this in one of the River Cottage episodes a few years ago. And you pick gorse flowers, which are the bright yellow flowers, and they smell of coconut. They're absolutely incredible. And they grow on coastal moorlands and places like that. You see them sort of over towards Suffolk and down in the southwest and maybe Wales. So, yes, you can use gorse. That's quite good. And you just, it makes kind of almost like a kind of fizzy wine. Dandelion wine, of course. That's all very... all very 1970s, blackberries, mulberries, elderberry wine. So I love this. And a final chapter here on nature's remedies for bruises, to stop bleeding, you know, pennywort for wounds, skin healing creams, nettle tea for rheumatism. And so in a way, considering he was essentially a kind of magnificent man in his flying machine, aviator, you know, descended from French aristocracy, right up there with what you would imagine to be worlds away from health foods and nutrition and being at one with nature and all that kind of stuff that we associate perhaps with the 1960s and the kind of environmental health movement and Holland and Barrett and places like that. He was actually well ahead of his time in this regard. And he was talking about not only food, but looking at the landscape as providing your medicine and your stimulants in the form of alcohols and syrups and wines, as well as sustenance. So I think it's just a lovely book. It's a reprint by Persephone, a fascinating book. And if you're particularly interested in sort of holistic things and nature and learning about, you know, the countryside and plants and herb lore and all those sorts of things, as well as how to cook a hedgehog, this is the book for you. That's all for this month on the Historical Bookshelf. Next month, I'll be looking at Trifle. Until then, goodbye.
Many thanks to Andrew Webb. You can find out more about Andrew and his food exploits by visiting his website, foodjournalist.co.uk.
Broadcasting from the University City, we are Cambridge 105.
Espresso Library opened on East Road on Monday the 9th of February. It's a lifestyle cafe where you can bring your bike inside, hang it up, or have your children sit down and learn chess, whilst you have a macaron made by Fiona McDuff, a previous winner from the Cambridge Bake Off event. I revisited Espresso Library to see how they're getting on, and what their reaction was to the immense response they had on Twitter and Instagram.
How's the first month been?
Wow, it doesn't feel like a month, although I suppose, I don't know. In a way, it feels like it's been forever, and now that you said it's been a month, I can't believe it. Really overwhelming, really busy from day one. Still kind of, in many ways, we're trying to find our feet, as it feels like it's getting busier and busier. Putting systems in is sort of a constant process, so it's been amazing, though.
Has the response been good?
Yes, the response has been overwhelming, especially on the first day. I remember getting a few minutes at like midday and looking at Twitter and seeing like 40 plus notifications and all of it just being crazy, and day in, day out, people saying that all they can see on their feed is Espresso Library. So very overwhelming and so moving in many ways, you know, to see this happen and see the beholder really kind of taking it on. So
great, yeah. Oh, brilliant. Thank you very much, Malcolm.
Thank you, Ruth.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. We are here live in the studio. You can contact us via email, studio@cambridge105.fm, and we're also available via Twitter @Flavour105.
Too good to be forgotten on Cambridge 105.
Join me, Mark Hickford, Monday to Friday between 9 and 10 a.m. for Too Good to be Forgotten. I'll bring you those tracks from the back of the music cupboard that just don't get enough airplay. Send your suggestions to mark@cambridge105.fm and I'll try and get them on the show. So that's me, Mark Hickford, with Too Good to be Forgotten, Monday to Friday between 9 and 10 a.m. on community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
Thomas Hobson was an important man in Cambridge around the time of the Spanish Armada's attempted invasion. He was a philanthropist, a horsemonger. He had horses available for rent at sixpennies a day. He owned an inn and a pub where the King Street Run now stands. Using the power of time travel, Matt journeyed back to 1588 to meet with Thomas Hobson and his wife Anne on King Street to find out what you could expect from a pub menu of that era.
Good afternoon, sir.
Oh, good day to you.
Good day.
What's your pleasure here in our inn today?
Well, I was just coming through Cambridge and I'm in need of a hearty meal and some good ale. And I'm just wondering what you're serving here at this house.
Well, we have a choice of drinks, depending on how much coin you have in your pocket. We have small beer to slake your thirst, but if you're after a stronger draught, we have a good table beer, twice the strength. Or, for a few pennies more, we have Rhenish wine, which is a white wine, which has some spices in to add to the flavour. And we also have claret blended to give a good pleasing flavour, a good strong wine from the area of Bordeaux in France. What would you be your pleasure, wine or beer?
A beer on this occasion.
Right. John, a quart of beer. And food, you say?
Yes.
You fancy a hearty meal?
Very hearty, please.
Well, my wife Anne has been supervising the kitchen maids and we have meat roasting before the fire. We have some capons. And we have... Oh, we do have some mutton. Do we have the mutton left, Anne?
We do. There is plenty of mutton.
And we also have a pottage, which is, in terms of the most heartiness you can have for the least pennies, a pottage is the meal that you may want. So in the pottage, there are some oats, turnips, lots of peas, of course, and some mutton, because it's a mutton pottage. Good, hearty meal, which you can have with some bread. But tell me, how deep is your purse? If your purse is deep, you can have the finest white manchet bread. But if your purse is shallower, we have a coarser brown bread for you, which you can have for less than half the price. So what's your pocket then, deep or shallow?
Well, I'm going to go for deep because I'm quite intrigued by the finest white manchet bread and what comprises that.
Right, well, bread, as you know, is made from mostly wheat flour, the ordinary table bread that we have. The wheat grains have a core of brown, and a whiter husk around it. If you just grind the grain up and make bread out of that, you will get a brown, coarser loaf. But if you want a finer bread, which will accompany the finer foods, the finer roasted meats and marchpanes that a gentleman or a lady may want, what you have to do is crush the grain and then start sifting it to separate the white from the brown. And it's a long process and it takes time, and so the cost increases. You also then have to bake it with more care. Because the bread, the flour is lighter, it will not take such a warm oven and needs to be baked for a shorter period. Now, the ovens that we have, as you see, there's one bread oven there at the back of the fireplace. It's like a stone-lined dome. And you see there's a little fire burning in the corner of it. And you think, well, that's not very much warmth, but it's enough. It keeps that bread oven the right temperature all day, every day, all year round. So you can make your loaves of bread, whether from the brown flour for the ordinary folk or the lighter white flour for the ladies and gentlemen, and you place them in the oven. They will quickly rise and cook. But there is a division. The bread is going in the base of the oven and there will be ash on the base of each loaf. So if you're a lady or gentleman, of course you will want the upper crust, which is ash-free, as opposed to the crust at the bottom, which may be slightly more burnt and may be covered in ash. What do you think this gentleman deserves, then?
I think this gentleman is about to die of starvation, Thomas. We should seat him and we should bring him his food.
That's a really... Yes, well, here's your beer.
So what
do you fancy, then? Would you fancy roasted meats?
Yes,
so we'll have to give you some roasted capons and some roasted mutton. But of course they're rather heavy, so we need something light as well. So how about some, say a light tart of some kind, say a cheese tart,
mm-hmm.
which is light, which is made of a curd cheese in a pastry base with some herbs. That's a much lighter meal. Perhaps some fish, perhaps say some soused herring. So you take the herrings and you roll them up, you place them in vinegar with some spices, ideally some pepper, and that's a very, very piquant taste. And that balances with the more oily nature of the mutton and the capons. You can also have something quite herby. You could have some grains with some herbs in it. It's a very traditional meal that goes back several centuries. Frumity is one of the old names for it. You can have some of that for a very small price indeed. It's as cheap as anything. But we have something new for you. Very hearty. A new grain called loblolly. Have you ever had loblolly before?
I never have.
Well, loblolly is a new grain that's also known as rice. So you make a pudding out of this rice, you add some milk to it and some nutmeg and some spices, and you make a pleasant, quite moist pudding out of it, and it goes very well with mutton indeed.
So the 16th century meals was always about balance.
That's right, yes. In terms of what most people had, the most people in England for most of history have ate the same thing, which is a pottage. So you can go back to even the Bronze Age and the Iron Age and people are eating a pottage, and that hasn't changed. And the more wealth you have, the more variety you have in your diet and the greater amount of meat. But the 16th century Tudor era was a time when people were obsessed with a balance, just as people in the modern era are obsessed with different kinds of diets. F-plan diets, G-plan diets, or whatever the latest thing is, separating proteins from starches or whatever fat it is. At that time, they wanted to make sure their humours were balanced. So never too much of one thing or the other. But there was also a difference between the genders. Balance of humours was different in men than women. Men were slightly hotter and drier than women, who were cooler and wetter. Men were more rational, women were more irrational. And so it was thought not to be good for women or children to have anything that was too spicy, too dry, too hot. So, for example, ginger cakes, wonderful things. Women would only be allowed a small amount of those, or pepper cakes. Ginger cakes are a really simple recipe that everybody can make. What you do is you take some breadcrumbs, grind them up in a pestle and mortar, add some ginger, grind that up, add some sugar or honey. If you have some other spices, such as nutmeg or cloves, grind those in as well, and keep banging away with your pestle and your mortar until you've got a really smooth paste. Then take your moulds. You need gingerbread moulds for this. They're made in many interesting shapes in Tudor England, in the shapes of people or animals, carved out of a good hard wood. Dust the inside of the moulds with ground spices as a releasing agent. Press the gingerbread paste into the mould, get it nice and flat, filling all the crevices, and then turn the gingerbreads out onto a parchment and dry them before the fire. You don't need to cook them, you don't need to put them in the oven, because of course it's made of bread which is already cooked. You just dry them, let them get nice and firm and hard, and if you have got more wealth than the Queen, then you can even put gilding on them. And that's a very good way to display your wealth, by having food that's covered in gold.
Thank you very much, Thomas Hobson. You are a vat of historical knowledge.
Well, if you're running an inn, the one thing you have is plenty of vats, isn't that right, Anne?
Indeed, it is.
Many thanks to historian and actor Matthew Ward, who was portraying Thomas Hobson at the Museum of Cambridge. That was actually part of a special event that was put on by HistoryWorks Media Production Company. It was called Hobson's Choice, Life in a Cambridge Pub, circa 1588. So many thanks to Helen Weinstein of HistoryWorks for letting me tag along. Roasted capons and mutton, a pastry-based curd cheese, not a single toilet in the entire city, and mole's paws to prevent rheumatism. 1588 lifestyle and beliefs. I'm really glad to be alive and well here in 2015.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
Well, it's warming up a bit, but the weather's still too unreliable to start sowing vegetable seeds. But there are preparations that we can be doing, and with some vegetables, you do need a long growing time, and to get it, you can start them off indoors round about now. Dave Fox of Trumpington Allotments explains, amongst other things, how to get your parsnips off to a good start.
Yes. Absolutely, yes. It's a little too early to be sowing most seed outside. That's because most vegetable seeds don't germinate until the daytime temperature stays above 8, 9 degrees Celsius. So you want to wait until that. That's usually maybe early mid-March. One good trick is to don't start sowing anything until you see the weeds growing. When the weeds are growing, you know, right, OK, time for action. So I've got a bed where I know I'm going to sow parsnips, and so hopefully be sowing them around early to mid-March, but I can prepare that bed now by removing the mulch material that I've left over it to protect it during the winter, and rake most of the material off, not being too fussy about it, and then leave the bed exposed to the elements for 2 or 3 weeks. And what's going to happen in that time? The first weeds are going to start germinating. And that's great news, because that means that in 3 weeks I can come along with a hoe, bash all the weeds down, hopefully a little bit of sunshine to make sure they're all dead, and then I can sow my parsnips, and those parsnips will have a little bit of a head start because I will reduce the weed competition, reduce the yeah. seed bank of weeds yeah. in the soil. I mean, that really pays off with something like a parsnip, which is slow to germinate and slow to grow early on. Parsnip's a tiny seed, so in contrast with the sea potato tuber, it's not got a lot going for it other than the genetic material and a little bit of skin to protect it. It's going to have to pull in most of its nutrients from its environment, and that's going to take a while.
Right. The parsnip isn't particularly prone to frost damage then, because so you will get frost after mid-March.
Yes, you would, and a really hard frost, I suppose, that might kill off parsnips, or a prolonged period of damp, cold weather might cause the seed to rot in the ground. I mean, never sow all your seed in one go. Keep half the packet back for a second sowing, just in case. Just with parsnips, they need quite a long growing season to get up to a good size. So if conditions are right in early March, sow some parsnips, but do be prepared to sow again in a month later if you lose them. Another trick you can use to get your seed bed ready is to cover it with glass, something like an old sheet of secondary double glazing, for example. I've got a number of those. Just place them on the ground now after you've done your initial preparation, and that will help to warm the soil up. Just get it up to that 8 to 9 degree germination temperature a little bit earlier than it would have done otherwise. So this is, you know, if you're really keen, if you want to get your parsnips started earlier, you know, if you're really keen to sow some seeds right now, then of course you can sow in pots and keep the pots indoors. So some of these summer crops that need quite a long growing season, like aubergine and peppers, it's not too early to sow a few of those now. Put them on the windowsill.
And when's it safe to put things like aubergine out?
Well, the problem with aubergine, peppers, tomato, all the Solanum family, is that they're not hardy to frost. So if you plant them outside and then there's even the slightest frost, that's going to damage the plant quite severely and probably kill it off. So it's a bit of a percentage game, really. If your tomato and pepper plants are ready by May the 15th, then by all means plant some out. But don't put them all out, because we've had frosts here at Trumpington Allotments, certainly frosts as late as 6th of June in previous years. So you want to hold some back just in case. Of course, you may well not have a frost from the 1st of May onwards. Mm. There was a
6th of June is late, isn't it?
Is
You're
late.
Unlucky if you lose your crops to that.
Well, yes, but it's a percentage game, isn't it?
Yeah.
There was a young couple from New Zealand who had a plot here a few years ago, and they had hundreds of tomato plants, and they must have started them off at Christmas, because these plants have been growing on in their conservatory, and they were fantastic. And they came along and put them out in sort of second week of April. And I'm saying, no way. There was no frost. They had a fantastic crop of tomatoes a month earlier than anybody else. So it just shows that it's worth trying. I just wouldn't put all your plants out that early. Yeah, other things that can go that you can sow now inside would be summer brassicas, something like cauliflower. Also onions that you're going to produce little seedlings and then plant them out. So if you're really keen to get started, there's lots of things you can do yeah. in pots now. Just as I say, it's a little bit early to start sowing most things outside just yet.
Never sow all your seeds in one go. Sage advice from Dave Fox at the Trumpington Allotments.
So have you started sowing things yet, Alan?
Well, actually, tomorrow I'm going to start sowing things indoors, so it's on the way.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
It was the World Book Day on Thursday, so I thought we'd take a little look at two of my favourite cookbooks published in the last few months. The first we'll look at is Deliciously Ella, which was published, I think, about a month ago. And while, yes, I do talk about burgers all the time, and yes, I would probably reach for the donuts over the kale chips, or both, I do love the healthier things too. It's also a trend in our city. Espresso Library has lots of vegan goods, offer up soya milk and their own homemade almond milk as their lactose alternatives. I see lots of pure fruit smoothies cropping up everywhere, even in chains. and it's become less difficult to find gluten-free. And the Free Press has welcomed Raw Food Rock Chick, a chef specialising in raw food, in its pop-up lineup. So Free From Food is having a very sexy moment. One of my favourite food blogs for a while has been Delicious Yella. It's a food blog that focuses on whole, plant-based foods, and I always start cooking from her blog when I've just been eating a little bit too much and need to take a step back, concentrate on veggies and not sugar, not fat, and, don't know, feel better. In January, her book was released by Yellow Kite, and I have already thumbed through it loads, showing how blogs can become books in the food world, something we covered in October. The author, Ella Woodward, gives you her set of kitchen essentials, from actual tools to ingredients you should have in your cupboard before delving into any recipes. She even gives you instructions on how to make your own dairy-free milks, which you end up using quite often in a lot of these recipes. And this is my favourite thing from the book, really, because buying almond milk, soya milk, etc. is quite expensive, and it is expensive to make, but, I don't know, you feel like you've done something, and it encourages you to make your own and know where your food comes from. She's clear with her recipes. Nothing is too fancy. After all, she isn't a trained chef, so it feels on my level, very easy, and not once did I get confused by instructions, which, believe me, I am very often very confused. The book has been divided into the ingredients. Chapters are grains, nuts and seeds, beans and legumes, vegetables, fruits, and then smoothies and juices. It makes it easy to navigate. For example, if you have a bunch of chia seeds you don't know what to do with, you can just flip to that chapter and job done. But it's actually one of my favourite recipes is the chia seed breakfast pudding, which you just soak overnight. It's basically the lazy human's healthy breakfast. So you wake up and it's done. You just add berries and stuff. I mean, have a look here. What do you think?
The thing about her food is it always looks so beautiful, and because of the colours, it does have that fattening feel that you want. So equally, you know, it's so healthy and
it just looks healthy. All the colours, you just think, oh, I'm eating a healthy rainbow, and it's just really nice. And her being a blogger first has given her a very personal writing style. It's just like a friend giving you tips and advice. I've been reading her blog from the beginning in 2012, I think she started it. So it's even more so with me. We followed her on her personal food journey with her wholesome lifestyle and on the book and the blog. And I think it's something you find in a lot of blog-based cookery books. Everything is very personal, very one-on-one. And that's not to say it's not a very stylish book. It's well laid out with beautiful pictures. Anything that caught your eye in here, Alan and Gigi?
Yeah, I think it's a nice book. It's nice looking. There's a lot in it, and that's what I like about it. There's a lot of recipes. And somehow the fact that the font is small, you know, she's not sort of trying to space it all out, is she? She's not trying to stretch it out too much. So it feels good. But you've been to one of her cookery classes. Gigi Perry is here.
Hello. I have. I went to one of her cookery classes when she was just writing the book. And so when I went, we did the beetroot buckwheat risotto, which is in her book, as well as the beetroot and chocolate sort of brownies. And we made almond milk and the kale salad. And it was when kale had a really bad rep. It was about a year ago, and people were starting to use it. And so it was great. And the recipes do work and are delicious.
Right, on to my next book now. It's by Yota Matalengi, and it's Plenty More. When Matalengi came to Ely Cathedral for a talk, for some reason I didn't buy the book beforehand, but I did so immediately after. And I'm quite glad, because had I gotten it signed, I don't really think I would have used it as much as I do now. This is a follow-up to his famous book Plenty, which I think changed the way a lot of people thought about vegetarian eating. Plenty More does that once again. He really makes all the vegetables sing in Plenty More and shifts the emphasis towards how to cook them rather than what to do with them. In true Matalengi style, the book feels both clean and colourful at the same time. I love the graphic illustrations peppered throughout and on the cover, and the clean, clear, beautifully bright pictures. Because like an amateur, I really need to see what my meal should look like when I'm cooking from a cookbook, just so I know I've done all right. It's laid out in different methods of cooking ingredients. Tossed, steamed, blanched, sweetened, braised are all chapter titles. No mention of boiled there, which is how many of us normally cook our veggies, I think. I really, you know, seems that we shouldn't. How do you guys normally cook your vegetables?
Well, I have started roasting them a lot in the last 6 months or so, and I think that's been good. You often get, you know, a caramelisation effect. You can put things like thyme on them, and it's just better than boiling. But being British, I still boil.
Well, I boil as well, but I like to boil them nice and quickly so that they're still crunchy. Not say, I'm sure I was looking through a cookery book and they were describing vegetables in the 70s who were always cooked to a pulpy mush.
Yes, yes.
Whereas that's clearly not the fashion anymore. But one thing I wanted to pick your brains about, Alan, was parsnips. I always roast my parsnips, but I didn't... Is there another way that you can
cook them? Well, yes, you can boil them or parboil them and then roast them, you know, either.
Okay. I love the caramelization from parsnips. I eat them like chips. Just chop them up, roast them, little bit of oil. Gorgeous.
Yes, they're good.
Parsnips now. One of my favorite recipes from this book is actually crushed lentils with tahini and cumin, which actually I think tahini and cumin might be nice on parsnips. It's got the braised lentils, it's raw onion, and it's perfectly cooked egg mixed in as well. I'm used to lentils being part of a soup or a stew, so sometimes they don't come out as nice and a bit boring. But this recipe changes things and mixes raw with the cooked, which for me is completely new. It was also the recipe that he demonstrated at his book launch in Ely Cathedral. And there was a really small plateful and a lot of people. And while it was probably not advisable, I did get a cold after. I definitely had a bite from the same fork I think maybe 50 other people had a bite from. But I couldn't resist. It was still really tasty. Not only does he mix cooking ingredients in Ottolenghi style as he does, he mixes flavours that I never would have thought before. For example, Brussels sprouts with pomelo and star anise and roasted at that, or sweet potatoes with orange bitters. I've only ever used orange bitters in cocktails. I don't know about you guys. What do you guys think?
Well, I think it's a lovely book. Again, the photography, you know, I say again because his other books have got very good photography. But things like the sweet corn slaw, the curry roasted root veg with lime leaves and juice, they just look, you want to eat them. Mm. You know, they inspire you to make them. So, looks great.
It does look really tasty. Again, everything, it's like you said, it's nice and clear. It tells you how many it could feed. So on each recipe it says 4 to 6, etc. The ingredients are to one side, instructions to the other. But it's also a little blurb at the beginning from Ottolenghi himself with suggestions or even a story sometimes. I've tried a good 20 or so from this book, and they've all been easy to follow and have turned out pretty great, if I do say so myself. It's the recipes, not me. This book is one I've been going back to all the time, and I've given as Christmas presents for ages, and I'll probably give it as a few birthday presents. And will continue to be something I go to all the time, especially when I need a vegetable moment after too many burgers. And what are your favourite cookery books? Tweet us at Flavour105.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
On to the Cambridge food and drink news now, and here is Gigi Perry to start us off with news from the university.
Thank you, Matt. Cambridge University Wine Society are selling a second round of tickets for their annual dinner, which is being held on Saturday the 14th of March, so do check out their website to get hold of one. And Cambridge University Food Society are looking for committee members for the next committee. If you enjoy finding new places to eat and sharing them with other people, then it could be the post for you. Email their president, Emily, to apply.
Thank you, Gigi. On to the city news now. For one day only, on Sunday the 15th of March, which is also Mother's Day, hint hint, afternoon teas will become a purveyor of afternoon tea. They'll be swapping their usual brunch offerings for a delicious menu filled with homemade cakes, scones and savouries with an afternoon teas twist. Imagine smaller versions of cafe favourites, including their cheese scones, cakes and Joe's mum's homemade jam. Afternoon tea, including your choice of Kandula tea or coffee, will be £18 per person. Email info@afternoonteas.co.uk with the number of places you'd like to book, names of guests/mothers, and select your first and second choices of time slots.
Supper clubbers Dough and Pasta will be serving a traditional three-course Venetian meal at the Six Bells Pub in Covent Garden on Saturday the 21st of March at 7pm, and that's £17. To reserve a table, call Cambridge 355-559.
On the 14th of March, Annabelle and Jamie will be serving up a four-course Arabian Feast pop-up at Sticky Beaks. That's on Hobson Street.
The Grain Store opened last night on Regent Street. A new Green King pub has taken over what was formerly the Avery.
Cambridge Food Cycle are starting up a new shared meal in the northeast of the city in addition to the weekly Saturday lunch at St Paul's Church on Hills Road. They'll be serving suppers for families on the first and third Wednesdays of the month at 6:30 p.m. Barnwell Baptist Church in Howard Road is the venue. Everyone's invited to the launch event from 6:30 till 7:30 on Wednesday the 18th of March at Barnwell Baptist. Please let Alex Colicks know if you're going, so he can get an idea of numbers. And the easiest way is via their Facebook page, or you can email cambridgefoodcycle@gmail.com.
The Cambridge Bake Off is back, with judging dates beginning on March the 14th and the grand final on April the 25th. So what will this year's bakers bring? Perhaps we'll have a new Fiona McDuff hiding in town somewhere.
The Cambridge Half Marathon is tomorrow, and if you're not running, you can find Steak and Honour there from 8:30 to 3 p.m. on Midsummer Common.
Eat Cambridge is back in May and looking for volunteers and sponsors. If you're interested, email hello, that's hello with an E, at eat-cambridge.co.uk.
Food Park have added a mini food park pitch on Tuesdays with Guerrilla Kitchen and Steak and Honour at their CB1 location on Station Road.
The Free Press on Prospect Row has added a few traders to their weekly pop-ups. Alternate Mondays bring Jalan Jalan and Buffalo Joe's, with Buffalo Joe's kicking things off this Monday, along with the return of the Free Press pub quiz. And Barbara Fernandez, aka the Raw Food Rock Chick, will be there every Sunday.
Finally, on our last programme, we featured Dingley Dell Pork Farm, still available as a podcast if you miss it. But there's a Cambridgeshire pork producer that sounds pretty interesting too, and they're also doing some fascinating experiments. They're called the Old Rectory Produce, and they're based at Streatham. They have Gloucester Old Spot and Tamworth breeds, but also Oxford Sandyback. They make rare breed sausages, and they're experimenting with salamis at the moment, including garlic and red wine, and also orange and fennel. If you're interested in trying these out, you can contact them via their Facebook page, which is The Old Rectory Produce.
And that is all for this edition of Flavour. There won't be the usual repeat at tomorrow at 7 a.m. We're making way for coverage of the 36-hour jailbreak event that began on Parker's Peace yesterday. That's the Cambridge Rags charity fundraiser, where students try to get as far away as they can from the city in an effort to raise £50,000. However, our dutiful Flavour podcast will be available next Tuesday, possibly even earlier. You can find it on the Cambridge 105 website, where the podcasts of previous editions can also be found.
Remember that you can keep in touch with Cambridge Food and Drink News by following Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105.
Coming up next, the Junction at 25. Drive Time's Julian Clover looks back at the last quarter century of the Cambridge Junction and the many acts that have appeared there. From 2 to 3, it's the new music generator with In Session. This is a new series hosted by Tim Willett, showcasing the best in local musical talent. And this week is the turn of 28 Boulevard.
From 3 till 4 p.m, it's an update on the Cambridge Rags Jailbreak 2015 that I mentioned earlier. And from 4 till 6 p.m, 105 Sport takes the helm, bringing you all the latest local sporting action, hosted by Alistair Hunter, Ibrahim Rahman, Dan Cornwell and Jack Langley.
Thank you to all of our interviewees today. Our next episode is in 2 weeks' time, on Saturday, the 21st of March. We hope you can join us then. So for now, it's goodbye from Flavour.
Goodbye.